Beginning the second week on John, and the topic for this morning is Mary and Martha, John 11, 1-53. Now I noticed that the group here is, for me, recognizably different from the group that was with us last week. So I want to just lead in to the work this week by reviewing or suggesting what we did last week. Last week, the book that I was selling from the bookstore, and the last time I looked there were two copies left, was the book The Community of the Beloved Disciple by Raymond E. Brown, with the subtitle, The Life, Loves, and Hates of an Individual Church in the New Testament Times. Raymond Brown is a Roman Catholic scholar who's really spent his entire adult life on the Gospel of John. After about 15 or 20 years of working on the Gospel of John, he published, I guess I could say, the definitive commentary on John in the Anchor Bible series, How Many Know It?, a two-volume commentary on John. But then 10 years after that was published, he wanted to get an overview for himself and for the people who have trusted him as a scholar all these years. And so he wrote the book, The Community of the Beloved Disciple, in which he tried to reconstruct the history and the drama of this community, which is associated with the Gospel of John, and then 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John letters in our New Testament. And the theme that we used as the overall theme last week, coming out of this, was life. That's not working. Maybe this one will work. Life. I think the communists have been here trying to. Life equals struggle. And we made the point that struggle is what you do with conflict when you're trying to resolve it and bring it to some sort of goal. So last week we began with the theme on Monday, Life Here and Now, and looked at John 5 and concentrated on two texts, John 5:24, where it says, anyone who believes has already passed from death to life and does not come into the judgment. The stunning statement of the theological position of the writer or writers of John's Gospel, which says, do not wait for the future, life is now. And then the other passage, thank you very much. See, the mysterious people from the room sometimes appear. And we sounded the theme of life last week with this text. Then we moved on the second day, and we'll touch with this text again under a different aspect this week. Under the theme signs of life, we looked at the first sign, the changing of water into wine, the wedding at Cana. And this week, when the theme is women in John, we will touch on that text again, because it is Mary, the mother of Jesus, who is the occasion for this first sign, or the impulse for this first sign. And we want to look at Mary. That will come the fifth one presentation this week. We want to look at Mary, the mother of Jesus, and see how much differently she appears in John's Gospel from the way she appears in either Luke or Matthew. But the third topic we looked at last week was under the title, The Shepherd Gives Life. We looked at the multi-dimensionality of the shepherd image in chapter 10 of John. Then the fourth presentation last week was under the theme Life for the World, and we looked at John 3:14 to 21, which contains John 3:16, which is usually taken out of context. God so loved the world that God gave God's only Son. But we tried to look in the fourth session last week at how, again, multidimensional the notion world is. Because in John's Gospel, the world is not only the object of God's love, but the world is the deadly enemy. That's why the theme life equals struggle sort of comes out of both the struggle of the Johannine community, the community of the beloved disciple, and also out of the way that the gospel writer or writers present the story of Jesus. Then the last topic last week was under the title Friends for Life, and we looked at John 15:1 to 17, I am the vine, you are the branches, and the second paragraph of that text where Jesus says to his disciples, I no longer call you servants, but I call you friends, and saw this as one of the places where the writer or writers of John's Gospel seem to be challenging hierarchical structures in the church and seem to be challenging even the emerging sacramental structures of other early Christian communities, because strictly speaking, there is only one sacrament in John's story that is instituted by Christ. Now, this will give us a little polemic kickoff. How many here are Lutheran? Wow. How many here had to memorize 10,000 questions and answers in Luther's small catechism? Even people in my age group shake their head. But, I mean, that's probably a bad pedagogical method, but Luther's catechisms are devotional and theological classics. And remember the definition of sacrament that we all have to memorize? I do. A sacrament is a holy act instituted by Christ, in which, by visible means, God, she's saying it along with me, God bestows and seals God's invisible grace. Now, we didn't have modern language. It was His grace, but not God's grace in those days, but that's the way it was. By that standard, which is the Lutheran standard, there's one sacrament in John's Gospel, and what is it?
Foot washing.
Exactly. So that's where we were last week. How many heard the devotions at breakfast this morning? Wasn't that great? I thought it had been planned for my presentation, he told me that it was not really planned unless God was doing the planning, because he was at the staff short version this morning, and he said, Peter, do you realize that we were scheduled four times to do it last week, and it got delayed and delayed, and we did it this morning. Mm-hmm. So it just absolutely set things up for me, because this seems to be the week for drama. And way back whenever in May, when I planned this leap and running barefoot through the Gospel of John, I had set up the second week as an exercise in looking at the women in John, But I don't want it to be a feminist week, because it's more than that, and I hope I can explain why I say that as the week moves on. But the titles for this week are Mary and Martha, and we want to do this one almost as a drama when we get around to it. Then the next one is The Accused and the Guiltless, John 8, 1 to 11, the woman caught in adultery. And the textual evidence is quite clear that this did not belong to the first edition or even the second edition of John's Gospel, but it's totally in the Johannine mood or idiom, so we're going to study it. Then the third presentation, I think it comes on Wednesday, is the woman of Samaria, and we want to do that almost as a play reading. That's all of chapter 4. Then Mary Magdalene will be up Friday, and we're going to touch on her what? Thursday, I have my day off, so I'll be Friday. And then we're going to come in for a landing with Mary, the mother of Jesus, looking again on Saturday at John 2, 1 to 11 or 1 to 12, the first sign, and then looking at this very interesting word from the cross, first word in John's Gospel, woman, behold your son, behold your mother, which in Roman Catholic circles and other circles is seen as the reconstituting of the new community. Now, last week, the book I was hawking at the bookstore was The Community of the Beloved Disciple, The Life, Loves, and Hates of an Individual Church or Community in New Testament Times. The book I'm selling this week, and I think there are only seven left, is a small book called The Word Disclosed, John's Story and Narrative Preaching by Gail R. O'Day. And I was so fascinated by the fact of the reading that they did at Matins this morning, because it fit right into what this woman has done. The outline of the book is from the comfort of this is the first chapter, from the comfort of slogan to the risk of experience, and that is the Nicodemus story in chapter 3, which we touched on a little bit last week. And the next chapter is from the comfort of tradition to the risk of experience, and that is the story of the Samaritan woman in chapter 4, which we will be dealing with, I hope, about the same way that we're dealing with this text. Then the risk of experience, how do we know, how do we see, chapter 9, the drama of the man born blind having his eyes opened, a text that was very prominent in our community of life last year, because Nita used that at a evening service, paraphrased it at this seeing and looking at yourself as a metaphor for the self-recognition and coming out of a gay or lesbian person. That's chapter 9. The main issue being Jesus, the light of the world, teaches us to see what really is. And those people who say they see, like the Pharisees, perhaps are the blind ones, and those who know their own blindness are the ones who probably learn to see. And then, from the risk of experience to the gift of life, John 11, 1 to 53, what we're going to deal with today, is sort of, there's one more chapter that I didn't put down. This is kind of the climax of this book, Gail R. O'Day. And remember the Matins this morning. God tries all these ploys to get people to understand, and finally sends the third person in the committee, the Word, to become flesh and dwelled among us. The title of this book is The Word Disclosed. And the drama she's talking about here in these chapter titles is you move, when you move toward faith, through misunderstanding, through struggle. Remember the title last week was Life Equals Struggle. And finally you come to understanding, to sight. How do we see? To knowledge. And through this, to the gift of life. Now that's the sort of structure where we want to be going. And I really hope there will be time at the end of this encounter, this somewhat dramatic encounter with the Martha and Mary story, there will be time for musing discussion, for letting things simmer and perk. Now I'm going to ask you a question. How many of you sitting in this room, and that includes people in the balcony, know for sure how the Gospel of John was used in its earliest appearance? How it was used in the community of the beloved disciple? What were the church services like, for instance? Do we have any? Do you know? How many know? Let's see hands. Well, here's one we didn't. What?
I think I know fairly well.
Pardon me?
I think I know fairly well.
Well, tell me.
It sort of paralleled earlier services, don't they, with the time for prayer and reading of the scripture.
Okay, that's very general. How did they read scripture and how much did they read? Well, I'm asking you the question because for me, you should know that I've said last week and I want to say it again. For most good, deep and hard biblical and New Testament questions, the only right answer is, I don't know. And then you go on from there. The only really honest and home clear answer is, I don't know. You go on from there to take little signs that you find in the New Testament and in the scriptures generally and let them, stick it into your imagination and you let your imagination run a little bit on how these things were perhaps used. We have, for instance, in some of Paul's letters, hints at what the church services were like, and apparently they were wild. Because one of the rules, one of the ground rules was, if you do speak in tongues, what do you do? For pity's sake, get somebody to interpret. And then if everybody's, it's not like our open prayers, apparently in the Lutheran tradition, even at our seminary, sometimes you say, like here the rubric is, and what else will the people of God pray for? I think most of the time, the people of God are keeping it a secret what they're praying for. But apparently in the Pauline communities, it said, for pity's sakes, take turns, right? Just one at a time, please. So there must have been incredible liveliness there. We don't have any such hints for the Johannine community. But if you had the fun that I have of sort of running through this thing year after year with the students who, if they don't think they have to know everything, can discover a lot of things, and with all the experts, Raymond Brown, Robert Kaiser, Gail O'Day, you get the feeling that this thing was read, probably intended to be read, in long, long, long stretches. Because as we're going to see today, when we read chapter 11, there are all kinds of things that happen in chapter 11 that kind of set you up for things that are going to happen in chapter 12. For instance, when the person of Mary is mentioned in chapter 11, it says, Mary, who anointed Jesus' feet. But, or was it his head in Mary? I can't remember, in John, because you've got those two traditions. But that doesn't happen until chapter 12. And if you'd been with me last week, you'd see how often I used sort of musical metaphors to explain what's going on in John. For instance, when we did the changing of water into wine at the wedding of Cana, we listed on this board up here about six key words that were sort of set in motion in this text, and then these words or motifs had their full musical expansion or play in subsequent chapters. That's the kind of stuff we're dealing with. Robert Kaiser in this book has a wonderful sentence when he begins. He says, someone has said that the Gospel of John is a beautiful lake or river in which a baby can wade or an elephant can swim. Absolute clarity at some places and then almost unfathomable depth at others. And I think if we are successful in going through this thing today the way I hope we can, you will not only be convinced of that, but you will experience it. But still on the topic of how was this thing used, how many of you here on Passion Sunday, that's sort of just before Easter, kind of wrapping up Lent, have not a sermon but a long, long reading? How many have that? One of my friends in Denver, with whom I have spent several years in this Wednesday text study, Bruce Herman, said he once tried in his congregation to change that rubric and to preach on Passion Sunday, and his people said, no, Pastor, we don't want that. Just read the scripture. We're used to that. And I checked in my little red book last night, and again for this year, you can either preach on a shorter text or you can read all of Matthew 26 and 27 and let the scripture, which is nothing if it isn't intentional literature, that's the minimal thing you can say, let the scripture speak. So in answer to the question, how was the Gospel of John used in the community of the beloved disciple? I can't tell you how it was used, but how I'm relatively certain it was not used the way we use the Gospel of John, and that is to hack out of the narrative a text for the day as a bloody chunk from a living being, and then you serve that up to the people. Now, I'm not totally negative about the way we do this, because sometimes when you have a gospel text, an epistle text, an Old Testament text, and a psalm, sometimes the committee, which worked not only for the liturgical commission, but we hope worked with the Holy Spirit, gets the three or four to march together. Very often, you have no idea how those four things or those three readings got together. I'm totally convinced that in the community of the beloved disciple, they used the gospel or their basic document, not in this little snippet cut out. So today we want to experience reading this chapter for itself. But I want to give you some program notes or something to watch for before we begin. Because when you look at the Gospel of John, it is like, but not totally like, a symphony, or today would be a movement or something. because it has certain musical properties, but the goal is not just the enjoyment of music. There is a spiritual and intellectual goal. The goal is that the word be disclosed, that you understand the word that has become flesh. The Gospel of John is like, but not totally and exclusively like, a drama. And this would be one act in the drama, because it is not just the excitement that you go along with, but a cerebral, a meditative, a thought thing is asked for, as well as some sort of a commitment. These things are supposed to produce and deepen faith, a faith that will see and know. So with that kind of basic introduction, I'd like to get to the program notes, or to the score of the symphony that I'm asking you to notate a little bit as we go through this, so you listen for certain things. Oh, we're doing all right on time. The first thing I want us to note, and it'd be a little bit like Jerry Evenrude asking us to sing something before the service starts, I'd like to have us look at the frame of chapter 11 in the Gospel of John, and somebody with a magnificent reading voice, maybe that'll scare everybody off, I'd like to have you read the frame, John 11, 1 to 4, and then 11, 45 to 53. And let me just get your head started a little bit. The issue here, as I say always in John's Gospel, is life and death. That's why we started off way last Monday with this text from John 5. Anyone who believes has already passed from death to life and does not come into the judgment, but is living the new life. And so the question that anyone will ask is, what does this life mean? And so the whole of John's Gospel is an answer to that, and an answer not the way we are used to having answers, but an answer which is a further question and a further leading us down the path of thought and sight and knowledge and faith and commitment. That's the medium in which John moves. So the frame will set up, again, these motifs, these melodies about life and death. I want you to read that. And then later on, when you come down to a very innocent little part of the narrative, where Martha asks her second question, and Martha is designated not as the sister of Mary, but the sister of, and not even the sister of Lazarus, but the sister of the dead man. There you have again the subtlety of that theme coming back. And then where it mentions that Bethany is close to Jerusalem, it evokes, what is Jerusalem in John's Gospel? The place where Jesus is lifted up on the cross. So the death motif comes back. Let's just practice that before we do our reading. This is the first sort of program notes or mark your score. Will somebody read 11:1 to 4 and 11:45 to 53, please?
Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair. His brother Lazarus was ill. Now the sisters went
to her. That's going to be mentioned, as I said, in chapter 12, okay?
So the sisters said to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness is not unto death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by the means of it.
And the two words that are deeply theological. The elephant is swimming. Glory and death are put together. But even the child waiting can understand that when the Son of Man is lifted up, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, the Son of Man will draw all people to him. Remember what that story about the serpent in the wilderness? A central sign almost. I remember in Sunday school how impressive that was when I was with my Grandma Larson in pre-Sunday school, and we had these little pictures, you know, that you would explain. And here were all these writhing snakes around all these people in the desert. And then up there was this beautiful snake that looks like what the doctors have, the symbol for the doctors. And then anybody among all these people who were looking at that sign, the snakes were falling away and they were living again. What a drama. Kid can understand it. Still in my memory. Okay, that's the first section. Now do the second section.
Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the him, and the Romans will come and destroy both our holy place and our nation. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was a high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all. You do not understand that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation should not perish." He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they took counsel how to put him to death.
Okay, so in a sense, all the scholars tell us Lazarus' death and coming out of death is an anticipation before Jesus' execution happens of what's going to happen to him. Another of this multi-dimensional part of John's gospel. Now, I want to also program notes or marking the score before we go into the performance. And notice, this is the drama image. Notice the players. Who are the players? The main human players are the sister team, Martha and Mary. Lazarus is a player. But the interesting thing is, Lazarus doesn't have a speaking part. He doesn't say a thing. He doesn't say a thing in this chapter, nor does he say anything in chapter 12 where they're having kind of a celebration. Good question, and we'll talk about that when we're done with the symphony or the movement or done with the play. Why doesn't Lazarus have a speaking part? Jesus is the central figure, of course, here as everywhere, here as everywhere, and notice how he leads both Martha and Mary from the comfort of slogan to the risk of experience, from the risk of experience to an understanding of the gift of life. And then notice the Jews. Last week, when most of you weren't here, we had a very dramatic week because Phyllis Taylor, who was on the teaching staff in the teaching about nonviolence, is Jewish, and she said early on in the week, so it was the backdrop for everything we did, she mentioned how terrifyingly anti-Semitic the Gospel of John seems to be, and we dealt with that in some very interesting creative ways. Here you will notice that the Jews are both the friends who weep with Martha and Mary, and also those who go to the Pharisees and help set up the plot to put Jesus to death. Very, again, multi-dimensional, not simple. Then the other thing I want you to mark in your program or on your score is to notice the moments of misunderstanding or partial understanding. This is very typical of John. The idea is Lazarus dead or asleep? Dead or asleep? And when you look at the, and then other things up here, why is Jesus weeping? Is he weeping out of sympathy? Or as the scholars point out, the words that are translated, Jesus is deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Both of those words really should have in their translation the note of anger. It's not just that he sympathizes with Mary and Martha, the family members he loved, and the Lazarus who was dead, a family member that it says he also loved. Not just that, but he seems to be angry. Is he angry that death invades the life of God's children? Or is he angry that they still haven't seen and understood? These are questions to ask. And then, again on the program notes, why are the two speaking parts, Martha's speaking part and Martha's speaking part, so similar? They begin with the same sort of confession. If you had been here, my brother would not have died. Then Martha, in her part, comes to a confession. And that's in verse 27. We'll read it just, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, he who is coming into the world, which is very, very traditional. It is the breakthrough on that's one dimension. It is also the breakthrough confession. Who makes that confession in Matthew, Mark, and Luke?
Peter.
Why does the Johannine tradition have Mary of Bethany make that confession? As we'll see later on in the week, in the resurrection appearances, it's in chapter 20, only Mary Magdalene and Thomas, who's not there in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, who are the first witnesses of the resurrection and who make out of that, particularly Thomas, the kind of recognition of new life that is the intent of the gospel. Anyway, there...
Is it Martha that says this or Mary that says this?
The one I just read, 27, is Martha.
Martha, okay.
Martha, and that's very interesting because you'd expect Mary to do that. Because what resonates in our memory is that Martha's the one that works in the kitchen, the women of the church, and Mary is the one who sits, and she's the ordained sister, you know, kind of thing. But it's more complicated than that and more multi-dimensional. But then Martha also hasn't got there the whole way. When Jesus is going to raise Lazarus, remember? She said, oh, Lord, you're not really going to try to do that. He already smells. So that's an interesting dramatic development in Martha. And then there's a different one, but similar one, in Mary. And this is sort of a question mark along the line in the margin of the score you're marking. Is Martha, who's also a real person, I believe a real person, also the symbol of the cerebral, the dutiful, while Mary is a symbol, also a real person, of the artistic, the joyful, so forth? I don't know. I just want you to look at that. Then notice the dramatic movement. Every time Jesus is about to do something about poor, stinking Lazarus, who's getting older and older and older, every time you think, now he's going to do it, what does he do? He sits down for 3 days or 2 days. Then he comes and he has these long conversations with Martha and Mary. And then finally, when he gets to the tomb, what does he do? Prays, has this long sort of didactic prayer. Now, is this just obtuse storytelling on the part of the gospel writer? Absolutely not. That is Gail O'Day's point in this whole interesting book. This is the gospel writer teaching through drama and reflection what it means to move out of your safe, comfortable slogans into the risk, into the new life. Now, with these program notes, let us do the play the way maybe the first community has heard it. Now, those of you who were with me last week know that one of my sort of unreconstructible sins is that I keep interrupting people when they read. I didn't succeed in the first shorter session to do that, but I will try to restrain myself to making little comments at the end of each section. So why don't we just start with this group or some group and just read it out loud and read it not too swiftly. Let the community of the beloved disciple, which exists in Holden this week, muse, and let your thoughts and imagination go where they want to go. Will you start, please? Belt it out.
Now, a certain man was ill, Lazarus, of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with anointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother, Lazarus, was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness is not unto death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by means of it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, "Let us go into Judea again." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were but now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of his world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him." Thus he spoke, and then he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awake him out of sleep. The disciples said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover." Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he meant taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and for your sake I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him." Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him."
Okay. Notice Thomas appears here, who will be picked up later and play a very, very prominent role. Now, the first Martha dialogue. Anybody?
Now, when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, while Mary sat in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection of that last day." And Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, he who is coming into the world."
Okay. She didn't answer his question directly, did she? She gave a good doctrinal answer. She didn't take the risk of saying, "Yes, I know what you say, you're as good as your word." Now, the Mary episode.
When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying quietly, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come to the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Then Mary, when she came where Jesus was and saw him, fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?"
Okay. And now, the drama at the tomb, 38 to 44.
Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay upon it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. I know that thou hearest me always, but I have said this on account of the people standing by, that they may believe that thou didst send me." When he had said this, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" The dead man came out, his hands and feet bound with bandages, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go."
I'm still asking the question, why doesn't Lazarus have anything to say? Well, don't answer yet. Okay, now let us come into the last section where the multi-dimension motif of life and death and what Jesus' death means for life comes to expression. Who will bring us home?
Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, "What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on thus, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and destroy both our holy place and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all. You do not understand that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation should not perish." He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day, they took counsel how to put him to death.
I don't quite know the questions I should ask. Maybe the first one is, do you believe that this is kind of the way they heard it? Can this story carry itself, or do we need both my program notes and the annotations at the side of the score.
It's a powerful story in and of itself.
This book by Gail O'Day is really a fascinating book, partly for me because I work at a seminary and we're a preacher factory. But one of the things she says about this text for preachers, she said, the preacher should not get to the tomb in her sermon any quicker than Jesus got to the tomb in the story. Which is a very interesting, again, open-ended admonition to the preacher. I agree. I think the story, what does it do to you? What does it do to you?
I notice in this time of reading it, are the tensions present. And, you know, for our having an overview, we know how the story ends, but we don't. They're in the midst.
Let me just interrupt and say, I'm thoroughly convinced that the community listened to this again and again and again, and each time heard and saw something different. Okay, you said this time.
And this time, several things that pop out to me is that the hesitancy of the disciples of you know, Jesus, the fear that Jesus is going to be stoned when he returns to Bethany, and the hesitancy of his disciples, and the comment that Thomas makes of, let us also go that we may die with him.
Of course.
The reflection that, you know, they question, you know, gee, should we even go with him? You know, he's going to be killed. And so they finally decide, okay, we'll go.
And let me just pause there. I don't know where your heads went when the movement was being played or the act or the scene was being dramatized, but just that little thing, let us go with him to die with him. That can be heard, because of the brilliance of this story, by specific ways in almost every age. In almost every age. If we go with him, we too are running the risk of death. If we go with him, I interrupted you, but I just wanted to pick that up. What else were you talking about? The tension?
Well, the tensions, of course, that the Mary and Martha have, as far as, you know, that Jesus could have healed them, but it's the people that are with Mary that come out. That kind of undercurrent there of, you know, but some of them said, could not he have opened the eyes of the blind man, have kept this man from dying? So this kind of that tension of the crowd, so to speak.
And doesn't that bring you back to what he said, this illness is not unto death, it is for the glory of God, so the Son of God may be glorified by means of it. There's this internal back and forth there. That question is answered in this particular movement or this scene before it gets asked explicitly. Keep going.
So that expectations of which must have been, you know, in the broader picture happening in the community, of so much underlying feeling of different parties of, why doesn't he do this, or why doesn't he do that, or he could have done this, or so that I feel is there. And then of course once he does do the Lazarus come forth, those people who witness this, the difference in their reactions to it.
Does anybody here, I mean, we could go on and each one of you could do your music. Does anybody here have an answer to my question? Why doesn't Lazarus get a chance to say anything?
I've been thinking about this, and there's a couple thoughts. He was symbolic. And
of what?
Of God's grace. He was symbolic of conquering death. But what came to my mind was the fact that he didn't have to do anything because he was a visible sign. He was one of the signs that they're talking about. He was the ultimate sign. He was the sign that said that Jesus had dominion over the power of death. He was the last thing that Jesus did before he went to Jerusalem.
Exactly. And so you're saying, but all the scholars, both the exegetical scholars, the liturgical scholars, and the artists say, was placed here, the Lazarus story, to let the readers know, yes, Jesus is going to death, but he will return from death even as Lazarus returned.
It's John 11, if you want to put it in musical terms, is an overture. It is an overture to the symphony of the Passion Play that is coming. It is a precursor. It is like a prologue and to a long story. And so therefore, it's a setup of all these themes of life over death.
But it's not only an overture, it's an overture that picks up stuff that's gone before. Even.
Right. It sets you up. It's a springboard.
Absolutely. And it sets you up into your life. You were saying, Mary, something.
Yeah, there's another way that it would strike me, and that is if Lazarus said something, he'd say, oh my God, I'm glad I'm alive. Get me something to eat. And the people would all focus in on, how does it feel? What do you want? Cream of celery soup or hair?
Yeah, well, what was it like, Lazarus? What was it like?
Yeah. And hurry up, let's get his bandages off. All the focus would be on Lazarus. It's like when I used to teach nursing, and I use it as an example to teach a point about some kind of nursing care. I would use an example of somebody being ill. The nursing students would focus in on the person and his troubles and stuff, and kind of miss my point that I was trying to make. And what struck me earlier in this was that it says, and so he sat, it says he loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus, and so he sat down for 3 days. And so I'm saying he's plotting something. So he's pulling the strings and all the rest of this, and I'm continually saying, what is he pulling the strings? What is he wanting them to learn? So it's.
And you're on the same wavelength as all these scholars who have been working at it all their lives. If Lazarus is the image or the foretaste or the overture to Jesus' death and resurrection, Lazarus cannot be allowed to speak because in John's gospel, it is only Jesus who speaks the words of life. It is only Jesus who says the I am. The New Testament scholar that's most influential on me is a man but now retired, Ernst Käsemann, and he has written a monograph on the high priestly prayer here, chapter 17. And he said, you've got to remember that the whole Gospel of John is nothing but a Christological tract. And everything points to the voice of Jesus. And this, and the silent Lazarus says, if you want answers, find the real one, Jesus. You had a statement.
The point's been made. Thank you.
Okay. Any other answers? Yes, sir.
Well, it just strikes me that the raising of Lazarus functions in the Gospel of John much like the Transfiguration stories in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, in the sense of preparing the reader for who, in fact, Jesus is, and also even with that type of confessional statement of Martha paralleling Peter's after the Transfiguration.
Yeah, I don't know whether I'm really on your wavelength, but it reminds me of something that happened in the first class. How do you interpret this? Why does Lazarus have to stink? And that's the meaning of the fourth day. The Jewish tradition was, after the third day, you know they're dead. It's not a coma, you know they're dead. And it was 3 plus 1. And I guess the reason I picked that up there out of your mentioning the Transfiguration, the Gospel of John is so very interesting because it, although it can be called a spiritual gospel, and it has this multi-dimensional dimensionality. It is realistic and not docetic at these key points. Lazarus is not spiritually dead in the way John is talking about it. He may also be a symbol of the spiritually dead, but Lazarus is really dead, stinking dead. It's like in the cleansing of the temple in John's gospel, which is a fascinatingly different from the cleansing of the temple in Matthew and Luke. Jesus is more violent there than in the other accounts. And the spiritual gospel is also very, very physical. We got 2 minutes left, and I wanted to say that Jerry Evenrud was with us this morning, and he, who is interested in the visual art, has all these illustrations of Lazarus. And you see, even as I make the point that you got to say in the John's gospel, it's all physical. The world became flesh, not an idea. The word became flesh and dwelt among us. But it is also true that there are all these generative spiritual meanings. And here Jerry showed me, here is a picture that he found, somebody sent to him, the prodigal son embracing the father, and it's the wrappings that were wrapped around Lazarus that are being unwound by that experience. Death is the breach between father and son, and when father and son, God and whoever the prodigal son is, us, when that relationship is restored, then the wrappings of death are unwound. A legitimate artistic picking up of this motif. He said, this figure here, can you see it? Wrapped in the wrappings and sitting with his head down, is titled The Waiting Lazarus. And here's an Eastern Orthodox picture of Lazarus getting ready to come out, and somebody back behind there discreetly holding his nose. So you have in the echoes of this text in arts, all kinds of